Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as the U.S. steps up measures to track and treat cases of swine flu, the acting head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says Americans should be prepared for more severe cases, possibly even deaths. No one in the U.S. has died from swine flu, but there are several dozen confirmed cases. And today, Mexico closed its schools across the country as the reported death toll there rises to 149. President Obama said this morning he's closely monitoring the disease.
And this is obviously a cause for concern and requires a heightened state of alert. But it's not a cause for alarm.
Well, let's see where we are here. Dr. William Schaffner is an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Schaffner, first of all, how serious is this? What's your sense of where we are in the swine flu scare?
Well, Robin, I think we're in the cautionary phase. So far in the United States, the cases have been mild, have been scattered, but mild. However, what's happening in Mexico is what has everyone concerned. Widespread infection, some deaths, and the involvement of young adults. If they get sick and seriously ill, they have not seen this virus before. And indeed, their immune system is so powerful that the very response of the immune system is what makes them so ill. It's paradoxical. It's called cytokine storm, and it affects the lungs very badly.
Right. How recently does someone have to have traveled to Mexico to possibly be carrying the flu?
Well, we're saying within the last week or two. Now, the incubation period for influenza is 24, 48, at the most, 72 hours. So if you've been in Mexico and you come back with an infection, you should be infected and have symptoms within 3 days, by and large. But we're being extra cautious here.
Well, and the U.S. has begun what they're calling passive screening of people crossing the border with Mexico, asking people how they feel, looking for signs of illness. This doesn't seem very effective compared to Japan and South Korea. They, of course, fought the SARS epidemic in 2003, and they are using thermographic imaging of airline passengers, essentially taking heat scans of them to see if they have fevers. And Indonesia is taking temperatures of arriving airline passengers. Should the U.S. be doing more?
I actually don't think so. You know, during the SARS outbreak, some of those activities were used and were found to be not very effective. Mind you, you can be infected with the influenza virus, and remember, you won't get sick for 48 to 72 hours. So you can come in with the virus and not have a fever. Also, fever is not constant during the day. If you come in the morning, you're less likely to have a fever than in the afternoon. So all of these screening tools are imperfect. We're doing the best we can with the technology available.
And of course, we should point out there were probably more deaths in car accidents this weekend than deaths from swine flu in Mexico. But of course, the concern is that once a virus can be transmitted human to human, it spreads exponentially. So that's why everybody is so concerned. But why not, if we know that the epicenter is Mexico, why not ban travel altogether for a while?
We're not quite there yet. We're waiting for the results of further investigations from what's happened in Mexico. Exactly how widespread is it? The Mexican Minister of Health has actually said their outbreak is abating. We'd like to see data to be reassured about that.
And did public health officials in the U.S. miss the development of this new strain of flu? Could they have been more watchful?
I don't think so. Diagnosing this particular strain of flu, this swine flu, requires highly sophisticated laboratory work. And as soon as it became evident that we have this new strain, everybody jumped into alert mode.
Well, the public health emergency declared yesterday allowed for millions of doses of Tamiflu to be released from federal stockpiles. It can go to states in need. We know there's been an outbreak in New York. Students who traveled to Mexico, there are fears of an outbreak at a private school in South Carolina. Again, young people returning from Mexico, that has not been confirmed. But we also read that it'll take up to 2 months to create a vaccine for this particular strain of swine flu. So will the Tamiflu, which again is a medication, not a vaccine, will that be effective against this strain of swine flu?
Sure. Those are the silver linings, that both the medications, the Tamiflu and the Relenza that we have available, work. And so if we start getting cases that are more serious, we who take care of patients in hospitals will have those medications available to to ameliorate the infection.
Is that possibly why we hear the cases in the United States are milder? I mean, we don't know if they've had those treatments, but is that one possibility that they've been, you know, treated for the cases?
Actually, the reports that I've seen indicate that the majority of the people have not been treated. So these have been mild infections that have resolved on their own by and large.
But what the Tamiflu can do is help ameliorate the symptoms of future cases and help people get well sooner.
Absolutely. It's wonderful that we have good treatment available, and then we just have to make sure that we get it started early enough, because in order for the medication to be maximally effective, you have to start treatment within the first 48 hours of becoming ill.
Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Schaffner, thanks so much.
And thank you, Robin. Let's all stay healthy.
Okay, question. Have you checked your company's severance policy lately? Just to see. Well, you might see that it's not what it used to be. The human resource firm Hewitt Associates surveyed employers and found that nearly a tenth of them are on the verge of reducing severance cash payments and benefits to workers they're letting go. And the HR firm Lee Hecht Harrison found that since the last recession in 2001, fewer companies offer severance policies in writing. But there's a silver lining. A growing number of employees are negotiating their severance packages, and employers are listening. Let's take a look at severance with Connie Thanasoulis Saraccio. She's a former Fortune 500 recruiter who co-founded the career coaching firm Six Figure Start. She joins us from WNYC in New York. And Connie, this is surprising to people. Most think it's set in stone, you know, certain number of years worked, certain severance pay.
You know, it's interesting. People think that they are powerless when they're laid off, when in fact there are so many things that they can do to control the situation. Remaining positive is the first thing, because if you're going to get negative, you're not thinking right and you're not being creative with your thoughts. And when you are laid off, we tell our clients everything is negotiable.
Well, let's tick off some of the things that can be negotiated. But first, you mentioned sort of your attitude. It really is important, isn't it?
Oh, an attitude is critical to everything in the job search process. You can't take it personally because...
Which seems impossible.
It's really, really tough. But look, things happen in life. There are worse things. You have to keep it in perspective.
Well, and you and others also say that if you keep your anger at bay, if you spend some time sort of working through what's happened and then return to negotiate and are professional and straightforward, it really will be better for you.
It will be better. We tell individuals, when you're in a situation where you're being downsized and you're actually in the termination meeting, there are specific do's and don'ts. What you really need to do is listen very, very carefully. You have to take notes. If you don't have a pen and a piece of paper, ask for it. You have to understand the reasons for the termination, because they must give you a reason. Ask as many questions as you can. For instance, I laid off this one person. She was in her early 50s. And it was a reduction in force. So the whole company was laying people off. She said, I'd like to know the percentage in my age bracket. And I said, well, we're going to get that to you. You know, that's a good question, and we'll get that to you. So ask questions. Also, understand how the severance is calculated. If it's a larger firm, it's probably 2 to 3 weeks for every year that you're there. If it's a smaller firm, they may just say, here's 2 weeks severance. Ask for something in writing. Most importantly, schedule a follow-up meeting. Because you're not even hearing what they're saying.
Okay, so now we schedule a follow-up. And here's the part where you can actually negotiate, although people think that's incredible. They think whatever you're offered, you take. Tick off some of the things you can negotiate.
There are cash value items that you can negotiate, and there are non-cash value items that you negotiate. As far as cash, one is your actual severance pay. Maybe you can get part of your bonus. Maybe you can get that paid vacation or sick time, or maybe you took no personal days in the last 5 years. You know, they can tack on a week or two for that. You can negotiate whether you want a lump sum payment or salary continuation to make it a little bit easier for yourself.
And what are the tax differences?
Yeah, if you're going to get a lump sum payment, you really have to sit with your accountant and say, look, if I could get 9 months salary within the year of 2009, should I do that or should I have half now and half in 2010? And it's really such an individual case, but you should absolutely speak to your accountant about it. Another thing are very, very important is your non-cash items of negotiation. For instance, outplacement services. If you're in a major corporation they can pay up to $5,000 for an outplacement firm to work with you and help you get a job. Now, if you don't need that, if you've already got something in your back pocket, or if you know how to go about looking for a job, you could say, look, I don't want my outplacement services. Save the $5,000, but I would appreciate an extra 2 to 3 week severance. That's a great way for companies to go.
What else?
Another way to approach it would be to say, look, you know, I can work. I know this product. I know this system. If I left now, it would be very difficult for it to go in a positive direction. Can I work for the next month as a consultant to you? You can negotiate your departure date. And then, of course, retirement benefits. You have to find out what you'd be able to get had you stayed at the company a little bit longer. And then health care is always an issue to you.
Well, we read about one woman who knew she was going to have surgery on her foot down the road, and she asked the company, can I stay through that surgery? And they said yes.
That's right. Yeah. They will do that. Here's another thing. Some firms, you can put money in a health care account to use for, say, glasses that aren't covered in the policy, or to pay for your copay whenever you go to a doctor. And some people put $2,000 a year into something like that. And if you haven't been able to tap that, if you don't use it, you lose it. So that's another thing you could say. If you give me 30 more days, I can do everything I need to do to recoup that amount.
Right. And you mentioned something else interesting. You said that companies are willing to sort of make it look as if people work there, even if they're not paid. And we understand one of the reasons you might try to negotiate that is, for instance, if you want to refinance your mortgage, you know, you won't be able to do it if you're not listed as working. Or if you're looking for a job, you look better if it looks as if you're still employed, even though you and the employer know you're laid off.
That's exactly right. You also might want a little bit of time to apply for a home equity line of credit, something that can give you a cushion, and you're much apt to get that if you're employed.
Well, this sounds like you're talking a lot about white-collar jobs and, you know, the world of bonuses. Mm-hmm. What about way down on the totem pole? Do people who, you know, may not be in such heady jobs, don't have the ability to call counselors like you, can they, you know, is there anything they can negotiate?
I think if you're someone who would never say that is not in my job description, if you're someone who always will stay the extra 20 minutes or 30 minutes to get the job done, you can use that with your employer and say, listen, is there any way I could get 3 weeks instead of the 2 weeks? Is there any way I can stay on and maybe decrease my salary? Maybe I could work 4 days a week, or you could pay me for 3 days a week. Anything to keep that going as long as possible. People are going to want to bend the rules as much as they possibly can.
Well, we're reading in ABC News a woman who was offered her 2 week severance pay, provided she signed a confidentiality agreement, and she flipped that around and she said, if I sign that confidentiality agreement, will you give me 2 more weeks? Can I get it up to 4?
That's right.
One other note, one thing an employer can't negotiate away is your unemployment. You collect that after your severance runs out. But some workers ashamed of being laid off are asking to sign something saying they quit. That's a big mistake because then you lose unemployment. We'll have more advice in a minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about how to negotiate a severance package if you're laid off with Connie Thanasoulis-Saraccio, a former Fortune 500 recruiter who co-founded the career coaching firm Six Figure Start. Connie, you say the most important thing is not to sign anything right away. Severance is a process, and as we just said, don't ever sign anything that says you're resigning because you won't be eligible for unemployment benefits. But some advisors are also saying to get your employer to put in writing they won't contest your unemployment benefits because some are. And you add, don't give them reason to contest it. Don't mess up.
The only time I've ever seen an employer contest unemployment was when the employee did something against the code of conduct or the code of ethics. For instance, if somebody was looking at websites they shouldn't have been looking at, if someone did something with a client that they shouldn't have been doing. So if that's the case, then they're fired for cause and they will not receive unemployment. It's you know, I am working with someone right now who did something like that, and it wasn't an unethical thing. It was just kind of a stupid thing to do. And he did not get unemployment, and it was tough because he's got two little ones at home. His wife was just wanting to leave her job to spend full time with the kids, and it's unfortunate. So, yeah, that is the case.
Okay. Well, but overall, I think it'll be a surprise to people that companies can do anything they want, so you can negotiate. But on the other hand, Connie, can they also pull the whole thing out from under you if you pressure too much? I mean, if you lose your cool, or can they take it all away?
I very rarely see people do that. I very rarely see a company do that because they want as little resistance as possible. So if they're laying someone off, the person will go away right off into the sunset with a little something. But I'll tell you one thing, things would go much, much, much better with a very good attitude, with a very proactive approach. Using the word appreciate is a very strong word. I would appreciate it if my severance wouldn't start until June 1st because I'm doing this, this, this. I would appreciate if I could get an extra week for each year because just last year alone, I saved the company $250,000. Maybe if it's a blue-collar worker, someone could say, you know, I've got two kids at home, and if I work here just three more weeks, I would be eligible for unemployment benefits, and that would make all the difference to my family. So it's a positioning. You're not in the seat of power, without a doubt, so you have to remember your place, and your place is one to say, how can I make this the best-case scenario for me at this point?
What about older workers? We understand if you're 40 or over, employees must be given at least 21 days to consider a severance offer. When should somebody bring in the lawyer, or should they?
Well, I think that it's really important to keep things as positive as possible and avoid lawsuits at all costs. These companies have very high-paid attorneys at their beck and call, and you do not. You're paying per diem, you're paying per hour. So you want to avoid that at all costs. The world is a small place as well, and I'm not saying that there are blacklists out there, but people know when things go smoothly and people know when things don't. With that said, if you feel that you're targeted for any specific reason, maybe that's something that you want to have a consultation about. You know, when firms lay off, they take very great care to take a look at the population of who's been laid off and what percentage are in what age category, what percentage are in what gender category. So it's something that's very, very important. For instance, if only women are laid off, I would say that they have a very strong case for what's going on here. If 50% of the workplace is women and 100% of the people laid off are women, that's says something right there.
Mm-hmm. Connie Thanasula-Seracchio, co-founder of the career coaching firm Six Figure Start in New York. Connie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, staying with employment issues, graduating law students with big-ticket jobs lined up for the fall are getting bad news, but at least they aren't completely losing their jobs. Law firms are being hit by layoffs. Nonprofits are desperate for pro bono lawyers. So one solution, law firms are offering graduating students less pay to defer their jobs for a year and do volunteer work. The law firm Ropes and Gray is part of this trend. Anna Francisco is chair of the pro bono committee there. Anna, what exactly are you offering incoming new lawyers?
Two things, really. We've made a program available to our incoming associates and also to current associates, and what they're being offered is an opportunity to work in a public interest organization for a year, and during that year, Ropes and Gray will pay a stipend, the stipend $60,000. We'll also provide them coverage under our health plan. And for law students who are currently in their third year and would be joining the firm in the upcoming fall, we're also going to reimburse them their law review expenses and moving expenses, which is something that we traditionally do for any lawyer joining the firm.
And somebody hearing this would say, you know, what? That sounds pretty good to me. But these students were expecting $160,000 salaries. So why are you doing this? Is it because of the economy?
It's not news, I think, to any of your listeners that the economic downturn has also affected major law firms. And for us, we do have certain practice areas where the activity hasn't been as high as it has in recent years.
So it is because of the economy, short-term, yeah.
No, that is what, but we also thought, well, what can we do that's creative here that will basically keep associates within the family? Some law firms are giving their lawyers a stipend to do nothing. We chose to structure our program differently because we wanted to encourage lawyers to contribute to the public interest and at the same time to develop their legal skills while they were doing it.
Well, and some people are saying that, you know, rethinking that is maybe not a bad idea, because some of these law students, again, making $160,000, and we understand some clients aren't particularly thrilled about having a law student, you know, represent them who's had no experience. This is going to give them some real boots-on-the-ground experience.
We certainly see that, and the firm also has, you know, a pro bono program that is very robust, and this will also help us to solidify relationships with a lot of public interest organizations that we work with all the time.
Ana Francisco, chairperson of the pro bono committee of the law firm Ropes & Gray. They're part of a nationwide trend to offer new lawyers a stipend to do pro bono work instead of the full salary job that they were expecting. Ana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll speak with Majora Carter, trying to move inner-city black workers into green jobs. That's tomorrow. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As General Motors negotiates its government bailout, some are wondering, could Boeing be next? The giant aircraft builder announced 10,000 layoffs in January, is 2 years behind schedule building its next-generation transcontinental jet, the Dreamliner, and saw its stock drop 60% in the last year. Jeffrey Rothfetter of Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine is asking, could Boeing become the GM of the sky? Jeff, first remind us, how crucial is Boeing to the U.S. economy?
It's very crucial. For example, in the fourth quarter of last year when they had a machinist strike in Seattle and Boeing was basically shut down for 2 months, the GDP in the U.S. fell about 6%. About 4% of that was all because of Boeing not producing airplanes and shipping them around the world. Also, it's the number one exporter, and they are an American manufacturer, the biggest and probably the most important to our economy right now.
The number one exporter in the country. Well, and they've had a string of bad luck, the Pentagon passing over Boeing's bids for contracts. But tell us about the Dreamliner.
Well, the Dreamliner is Boeing's new plane. And what it is, it's a transcontinental plane. It's going to look like no other plane. When you enter it, the ceiling was not going to look like a big tube. It's actually going to look like a room, and the chairs are really comfortable, and there are long windows and so on. So it's an amazing product, and it's gotten a huge number of advance orders. Main problem is that Boeing went too far in what we've all been reading and hearing a lot about lately, which is called outsourcing, which is shipping the manufacturing of parts and components to factories all around the world, including China, obviously. What Boeing did with the Dreamliner is outsource everything, even the manufacturing of the product, meaning all the parts, and then these suppliers out there were supposed to put all the pieces together also, and then ship like three or four big pieces to Boeing, and they would do the final assembly. Lo and behold, a lot of the suppliers couldn't do something as sophisticated as that. When they shipped the parts, things didn't fit together. Even rivets that arrived didn't arrive long enough, for instance. It was a complete breakdown of the supply chain that Boeing had created.
Boeing is charging $200 million for the Dreamliner. It had about 900 advance orders. How many are being canceled?
Well, already over 30 have been canceled in the past couple of months, and from what I'm hearing, there's probably going to be 50 or 60 more that are going to probably be canceled. And of course, the worst part about this for Boeing and the carriers, the airplane companies, is the fact that, you know, now we're in a recession and people aren't traveling the way they used to. So Boeing could have actually made money on this for 2 years.
Right.
Instead, they sat on their hands and they've actually lost a lot of money on it.
Well, meanwhile, you write Boeing makes about 777s a month. Mm-hmm. They have a backlog of 350 orders for that plane, which sells at $250 million a plane. And they build it on this remarkable slow-moving assembly line, all in-house. Is Boeing saying they've learned a lesson there?
They don't want to quite admit that. They do admit that they are learning lessons and that they're going to have to sort of rethink how they do things in the future. But I don't think they've completely learned the lesson. I think a lot of manufacturers still believe that they can do things on the cheap, and that's the main reason Boeing tried to do this. They thought it was going to be a cheaper process for them if they farmed out all the work.
Jeffrey, what does this mean for just, you know, the rest of us? What could it possibly mean if Boeing has to go to the government hat in hand?
Well, it's going to take a lot of money to allow Boeing to survive. So one thing, it would have to be a huge bailout. The other thing is, of course, the number of jobs. I mean, Boeing has still, even after the layoffs, over 100,000 jobs in the U.S., and many of them in the Seattle area, which has basically held up that economy on, you'd have to say, Boeing and Microsoft. And so if that falls, that part of the country, which is still holding up reasonably well, will really tumble, and that's a key part of our economy. economy. So I think Boeing actually would have a larger impact ultimately than General Motors does at this point, because General Motors had already become a much weaker company, and Boeing is a very successful company until the last couple of years.
Well, Jeff, one last weird economic question for you. We just received word that Portfolio is folding. Now, you've just heard this as well. You're a freelance writer, but had been considering going under contract with the magazine. Your thoughts on it shutting down?
Well, you know, it's a tough situation, and publishing has gotten really hurt in this economic downturn. And it's ironic that Portfolio, which was actually doing what I think was very, very good work covering the economic crisis, has become the latest victim of it. Unfortunately, for a lot of writers, the opportunities are shrinking, and so journalism is going through a major change. But it's very sad for the magazine, and I think it was doing very good work covering the kinds of information that we need to know right now.
Right, and now a victim of it. Jeffrey Rothfetter, formerly of Condé Nast Portfolio. Jeffrey, good luck, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, before we go today, what comic Steve Carell and the Reverend Jesse Jackson have in common, a movie changed their lives. Back in just a bit, here and now. A recent report in the British Medical Journal shows that because of a combination of public policy and a cultural preference for sons, there are 119 boys born in China for every 100 girls. As a result, there are 32 million more young men in China than women, the unmarried men, called bare branches. It's partly because of China's family planning policy, which was instituted in 1979 to curb the huge population growth encouraged by Chairman Mao. But the current policy, the one-child policy, is often called the one-and-a-half-child policy because in many areas, if a couple's first child is a girl, they're allowed a second shot at having a boy. And the cultural preference for boys is so strong in China, because it's thought boys will take care of aging parents, that with sonograms available in most of the country, women are learning the sex of their fetus and often aborting it if they're female, even though these sex-selective abortions are banned. So Chinese officials have launched programs like one called Care for Girls, designed to teach Chinese families to value their daughters, with health classes for the girls so they know what care they should get, and financial rewards for families that choose to raise their girls. Therese Hesketh is a lecturer at the Center for International Health and Development at University College London and a visiting professor at China's Xinjiang University. She also co-authored the study published by the British Medical Journal. Dr. Hesketh, what are some of the concerns in China because of this gender gap?
Well, a lot of commentators have got great concerns about this in terms of large numbers of excess males and what they might do with themselves. There are implications for social unrest. There are implications for things like the sex industry. There are implications for levels of crime and violence in society. And the government itself has actually come out and stated its concerns in all those areas. However, I have to say that we are currently doing research in this area, and we're finding actually that these excess males, these men who are in the lower echelon of society, they're actually rather introvert. They're not the violent men with criminal tendencies. If anything, we're going to see an underclass of disenfranchised men.
These are the bare branches.
Exactly. The bare branches are, because in societies where you get excess men, women can marry up. That's what happens. So women will marry men who are better off than they are, better educated than they are generally. So the men who won't get married are going to be the least educated and the poorest members of society, which is extremely sad.
Well, we understand that there's already been a higher rate of kidnapping and trafficking of women for marriage in China. And we talked about this potential problem before your study came out, you know, months ago. There was fear that down the road, China would, you know, see the need to funnel all of these single men into a huge army to sort of have them contained somewhere. So, you know, obviously there are some concerns.
Indeed, we went into our research certainly thinking that would be the case. Huh. In fact, these men, they're introvert, they're shy men, the kind of guys who can't get the women. That's what these guys are. And we're looking at crime levels in areas with high sex ratios and low sex ratios, and we can't find any differences.
Well, let's put the men aside for a second and look at the other side of the gender gap. And you've said that one of the biggest problems is that the one-child policy and also the policies to change, the new policies to change the gender gap, are sort of implemented in different ways all across China.
Yes. I mean, China's a gigantic place. It's largely rural. and what happens from place to place, usually dependent on how local officials decide to implement policy. I've been to adjacent villages, for example, where in one village, most of the families will only have one or two children. In a neighboring village, many families may have three children, simply because in that area, for some reason, local officials will allow that to happen.
You say that some women will leave their region to have an illegal sex-selective abortion. Others will leave their region to have an illegal live birth. Well, decades ago, before the one-child policy was instituted, the cultural preference for sons was so strong that baby girls were drowned in buckets. Thankfully, those days are over. But what are women doing today to get around that one-child policy if they have a girl and want a boy? We read reports that they may let their young daughters languish if they're sick, or maybe not feed them as much food as they would a son, in the hopes that the girls will die and give the parents another chance at a boy.
That does happen. I must say, from my own experience of working in what is a very expensive intensive care in China for newborn babies, is that we have more boys than girls on the intensive care units. So a very sick baby girl, parents might not invest that huge amount of money which it costs to save a very premature baby girl.
Well, we understand that's why one of the things researchers noticed before they noticed the gender gap is they noticed the spike in mortality rates for girls.
Yes, that's true. However, one of the benefits, if you like, if you can call it a benefit, of access to sex-selective abortion is that one can argue that girls who are born then are wanted girls.
Yeah, the whole equation changed when almost all of China was able to have sonograms and
exactly.
abortions, and that changed everything. But how have the new programs that instituted, the care for girls, how have they changed that thinking that a girl will be wanted?
To change millennia, you know, of son preference is going to take a long time, particularly in rural China. But there's no doubt that the Care for Girls campaign has been successful in these areas in which it's been operating. And attitudes are slowly changing. And certainly enforcing this existing law on sex-selective abortion is one of the things that really can be done at a local level.
Enforcing the ban that already exists.
It's a ban that already exists, and the enforcement is very patchy. What women tend to do is they'll go to one practitioner to have an ultrasound and they'll find out the gender, and they'll go somewhere else to have the abortion. So the person who does the abortion doesn't know, in quotes, what the reason is for the abortion.
We understand other things a family might do is sell a girl child on the black market, not register them with the state so they just don't exist and therefore they don't go to school or get educated. Again, so that the families can qualify for that half child, that second pregnancy to try to get a boy child. But, you know, they also give them away. Children end up in orphanages. And I'm just wondering, Dr. Hesketh, how much, if at all, does the American trend of adopting girls from China impact the gender gap in China?
The overall numbers of adoptions from China to overseas, mainly to the States, of course, is actually relatively small compared to the overall population mm-hmm. of the country. But there are concerns, and I think the government is now actually thinking about trying to restrict the number of girls who are being adopted because it's going to be made easier for Chinese couples to adopt children.
Well, and also the government is trying to reverse the thinking and have the Chinese see that girls are valuable. And
indeed.
And if you're exporting them, it doesn't feel that they are.
Absolutely. That's true.
I'm sure you would say also there are of course, Chinese families that revere their girls. And Chinese-American families, people outside of China, you know, who would find this conversation somewhat offensive. So we want to have said that. But have you met Chinese in China who have changed their minds?
Yes, very much so. I mean, even in urban China now, there are many people who would find this conversation also difficult to understand, even though they live in that country. But, you know, amongst educated Chinese who have daughters or have a lot of female friends and so on, you know, they would also find this conversation difficult because they wouldn't understand why people are so concerned about having boys. I've got many friends who would say they're very happy with their girl, they're very glad they've got a girl, or ones who are expecting children, you know, well, haven't yet had children, who say they'd prefer to have a girl, partly because, you know, it's now become known that there is a sex ratio issue and it's getting much easier for girls to get married and for women to marry up.
Of course, something that could change all of this in a heartbeat would be a Social Security program.
Well, yes, indeed, it would help a lot, yes.
Yeah.
And I think girls are taking on the role of the care for their parents in a way that wasn't seen, you know, until this generation.
Therese Hetzketh is a lecturer at the Center for International Health and Development at University College London and a visiting professor at China's Xinjiang University. She also co-authored the study of China's growing gender gap published by the British Medical Journal. Dr. Hetzketh, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Welcome back to Here and Now. What's your favorite movie? Maybe a tougher question is, what's the movie that changed your life, made you see the world differently? That's the question that Variety editors have asked over the past few years of everyone from comic Steve Carell and the Reverend Jesse Jackson to actress Sarah Jessica Parker and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Their answers have been collected in the new book, Varieties, the Movie That Changed My Life, and Robert Hoffler, a senior Variety editor, joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Bob, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
When you ask something like, what's the movie that changed your life, were there people who were hesitant about framing a question that way because maybe it gave too much power to a movie?
Well, when people hesitated, I always said to them, tell us about the movie that changed your life a little bit. and I think particularly the major way in which the movies do change our life has actually to do with sex and romance and love. That is where what it is to be a desirable man or woman, you know, really has been shaped by the movies. And you have someone like Doris Kearns Goodwin, who had said that she saw Gone with the Wind at a very impressionable age and that, you know, she wanted to marry Rhett Butler. But, of course, she had to unlearn that Rhett Butler was not, you know, husband material.
Well, let's remind ourselves of that relationship. Here's a snippet from Gone with the Wind.
Sir, you are no gentleman.
And you, miss, are no lady. Oh. Don't think that I hold that against you. Ladies have never held any charm for me.
First you take a low, common advantage of me, then you insult me.
I meant it as a compliment.
When we first started on this project at Variety, because a few of these profiles were first published in Variety, we were asking people outside the entertainment business because we thought it was more unusual, not the way in which a Sarah Jessica Parker or a Steve Carell would see a movie and then want to be in the movies, but Tom Brokaw seeing something like His Girl Friday and wanting to be a journalist. James Cramer of Mad Money, financial analyst,
yeah,
seeing, you know, something like Godfather 2, and really, in his opinion, the Godfather 2 making a comparison between the mafia and Wall Street.
Here's Michael Corleone in Godfather 2 negotiating for a gambling license with a Nevada senator.
The price is $250,000, plus a monthly payment of 5% of the gross. Of all four hotels, Mr. Corleone.
Now, the price for the license is less than $20,000, am I right?
That's right.
Now, why would I ever consider paying more than that?
Because I intend to squeeze you.
Another one would be Ray Bradbury saw Singin' in the Rain, and you would not think of Singin' in the Rain as a science fiction movie, but he did because it was how an invention changed the world, and of course the invention being, you know, the invention of sound with movies.
I think you should wait.
Every studio is jumping on the bandwagon, Dexter. All the theaters are putting in sound equipment. We don't want to be left out of it.
But we don't know anything about this gadget.
What do you have to know? It's a picture. You do what you always did. You just add talking to it.
And it was a couple of years after that that he wrote Fahrenheit 451. And so a movie like Singin' in the Rain changed his idea of what a science fiction novel could be.
You know, it's funny, as we speak about these films, how many there are. You know, how many great films, because each time I think I've got my favorite lined up, then I hear about someone else's. And I think, oh, no, that one too. And one of them seemed to be the most cited across the board. It's Stanley Kubrick's 2001. You have astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson, Asa-Pekka Solonen of the L.A. Philharmonic, Frank Rich, the columnist, Larry King.
2001 came up a lot. Larry King thought it really taught him to hate computers, and he doesn't like computers to this day. Mm-hmm. And then you had Esa-Pekka Salonen, who was seeing it. He saw it in Helsinki when he was 10 years old, and it taught him about transitions in art. And he talked about the moment in which the ape throws the bone into the air, and then the bone turns into a spaceship. And he thought that was one of the great transitions in art. And he said that a number of modern composers he's talked to have talked about that moment and what it meant to them and what they learned from it.
Well, from 2001, A Space Odyssey, let's move on to the Reverend Jesse Jackson's choice, which he said was Douglas Sirk's 1959 film Imitation of Life. Why? What did it for him with that?
There are a number of stories in Imitation of Life, but the one that he latched down onto, which was almost a secondary story, was a character played by Susan Conner. She played an African-American teenage girl who could pass for white, and she tried to because she was ashamed of her African-American mother.
I don't want to have to come through back doors or feel lower than other people or apologize for my mother's color.
Don't say that!
She can't help her color. But I can. And I will.
Jesse Jackson had not seen on screen the way in which someone can internalize the bigotry of a society at whole. And he said that that movie was the first movie that really reduced him to tears. What was intriguing to me about that is that The Imitation of Life was also mentioned by Isaac Mizrahi. And Isaac Mizrahi said, you know, I didn't get any of the racial stuff with that movie, but Lana Turner just wore all these fabulous dresses. I saw it when I was 10 years old, and, you know, I immediately wanted to design dresses. So you have this same movie that is viewed so radically differently by different people.
Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, now one of the leaders of the GOP, it was really fascinating because he wanted to be a director for some time, and the first film he saw that really psyched him was Traitor Horn. Why Traitor Horn?
Traitor Horn is set in Africa. The town that he grew up in was thinking about having a zoo, and he saw this movie with all these African animals, and he immediately wanted a zoo, so he went to town hall, told them, we have to get a zoo. They thought it was so kind of cute that here was this 10, 11-year-old kid that they let him in on a council meeting, and then there was a newspaper reporter who put the story about this, you know, 10-year-old kid who had seen Traitor Horn and was petitioning the town to create a zoo. And it ended up on the front page, and so he said that that movie directly led him to being a politician. Hmm. That's the way in which the movies can psych us up.
Bob Hoffler, I just have to ask, here you are, an editor at Variety. What was a movie that you saw?
Well, there was a movie that changed my life before I saw it, and that was Cleopatra. And I was so taken by this love triangle of Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, and Eddie Fisher that I fixated on that. And also, if you remember, Cleopatra cost $40 million, which would be like $400 million today. I knew everything about that movie before it was released. Of course, when I saw the movie, I found it unendurable.
Bob Hoffler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Robert Hoffler's book is Varieties, The Movie That Changed My Life, 120 Celebrities Picked the Films That Made a Difference for Better or Worse. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.